Kamala Harris closes out the DNC.
I accept your nomination to be president of the United States of America.
Plus, the U.S. sends more manpower to the Middle East.
We've moved capabilities into the region that I think it's fair to say have gotten into the headspace of Iran and will influence their calculation on how and if they choose to respond. And it also sends a message that, you know, we will stand with Israel.
And later, India's prime minister is in Kyiv. Turkish diplomats are in the Horn of Africa. Today is Friday, August 23rd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Donald Trump and the Republicans wrapped up their nominating convention last month. That was before Joe Biden dropped out of the race and threw his support to his vice president, Kamala Harris. Thursday night in Chicago, it was the Democrats' turn, and in a packed arena and on millions of TV screens, Kamala Harris accepted the nomination to be the Democratic Party's presidential candidate. She contrasted her record and vision to that of her rival, saying that Trump wants to take America backwards as she is looking forward. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara reports from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
What about us? What about all the times you said you had the answer?
Riveting musical performances during the final night of the Democratic National Convention included Pink, and national anthem sung by country group The Chicks.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light?
But Kamala Harris was the star of the night.
On behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth, I accept your nomination.
Harris told her personal life story, connecting it to middle-class voters' experiences.
We are charting a new way forward. Forward to a future with a strong and growing middle class, because we know a strong middle class has always been critical to America's success. And building that middle class will be a defining goal of my presidency.
She highlighted her background as a former prosecutor, in line with her party's strategy to contrast against Republican nominee Donald Trump, who has been convicted in court. Like many other speakers, she warned of a document outlining extreme right-wing policies linked to Trump. The former president denies it.
And we know what a second Trump term would look like. It's all laid out in Project 2025, written by his closest advisors. And its sum total is to pull our country back to the past. But America, we are not going back.
Inside the convention, it was all applause. Outside, pro-Palestinian rallies were held every day.
The protests outside have not swayed Harris' position on the war on Gaza. While she called out for more protection and aid for Palestinians, she reaffirmed support for Israel's security. She called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and a pathway towards a two-state solution.
Gaza is the Democrats' one area of disagreement. Out of around 4,700 delegates, 270 signed a petition demanding that the U.S. stop arming Israel. Harris' address to the nation came just a month after President Joe Biden announced he would not seek re-election.
Joe, I am filled with gratitude. Your record is extraordinary, as history will show. And your character is inspiring. And Doug and I love you and Jill and are forever thankful to you both.
As Harris spoke, Trump sought to reclaim attention by visiting the U.S.-Mexico border and hosting a social media event. but nothing dampened the delegates' enthusiasm.
She's setting us up for the future, a future we've been waiting for, a future that really represents everybody in this country. And we are elated that the Wicked Witch is dying and we're moving forward with a good life.
Kamala explained exactly what's at stake for this country. We're all flying the American flag. We all have USA, and that's for a reason, because this is a fight for this country.
Running mate Tim Walz joined Harris on stage to close out the convention with just 74 days to the election. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Chicago.
Well, if it's Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, whoever becomes the next president will have their hands full on day one. That's as the U.S. continues to lead the push for a ceasefire in the 10-month-old Israel-Hamas war. Negotiators were set to return to talks in Cairo by the end of the week, after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited the region earlier. VOA's Laurel Bowman has more from Washington.
Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip killed at least 22 people Thursday, Palestinian health officials said, as fighting raged in the Israel-Hamas war. Gaza resident Majid al-Dabak says he lost relatives in the strikes. This against the ongoing backdrop of regional peace negotiations.
The house was blown up and everyone inside, children, men, women, flew out as if the house had never been built.
Gaza health officials say 10 months of Israeli strikes have killed more than 40,000 Palestinians. Israel says its attacks target the U.S.-designated terror group Hamas, which killed 1,200 people and took hundreds of hostages in an attack on October 7th. Thursday also brought the announcement that another U.S. warship entered Mideast waters, with tensions high over a possible Iranian strike on Israel. Tehran has pledged retaliation for the killings of senior leaders of Hamas and Hezbollah, two of its allies in the region. U.S. Defense Department Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh speaking Thursday.
We've moved capabilities into the region that I think it's fair to say have gotten into the headspace of Iran and will influence their calculation on how and if they choose to respond. And it also sends a message that, you know, we will stand with Israel.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken returned from the Middle East this week. He said negotiators presented a proposal that addressed the remaining gaps between Israel and Hamas.
With our partners in Egypt and Qatar, our message is simple, it's clear, and it's urgent. We need to get the ceasefire and hostage agreement over the finish line.
Experts in Arab-Israeli relations say the work of Arab negotiators is key to calming tensions in the region.
If the Arab mediators are aware that Israel has kind of, has met the Blinken bridging proposal, I sense that will be conveyed to Iran and elsewhere, saying, hey, we got Israel signed on. We don't have Hamas, but we're going to keep trying.
Israel says it must end Hamas's security threat. Hamas wants a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. The United Nations estimates that 90% of Gaza's 2.1 million people have been displaced since the war began last year. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Elsewhere in the Middle East, Iran says authorities have detained a policeman who shot and wounded a 31-year-old woman in her car last month in an incident that provoked outrage from international rights activists. Activists say Arizo Badri, a mother of two who was partially paralyzed in the shooting in northern Iran, was targeted because her car was under a confiscation order because of her refusal to wear a mandatory hijab in the vehicle. Iranian state media said police opened fire because Badri ignored orders to stop. An Iranian judiciary spokesman said the shooter was under investigation, but denied there was any connection to the hijab enforcement. Iranian women's rights activist and VOA Persian TV host Masi Alinejad published the first photos and video of Badri after the shooting, showing her hospitalized in Tehran. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with her and asked about the sources who sent her the images.
I cannot share the details who are providing all the information because the Iranian regime is going to after them and arrest them rather than punishing those who actually shot Arzu for the crime of just simply showing her hair. So unfortunately, I cannot tell you about my source, but the source actually told me in advance that Arzu herself and her family were under pressure to do a false confession. And after 2 days, when I published the information, I warned the international community that this woman is at risk or being forced to go on TV. Now you see that the Iranian state television published a false confession.
So that video that you referred to, it's a short clip by Iranian state media, and Arzu is answering a state media reporter's question about how she's doing. She says she's okay. Her father's next to her. He also says that she seems to be treated okay. But when you talk about a forced confession, what exactly are Arzu and her family being pressured into saying, and who is pressuring them?
I mean, first of all, I have to say that a false confession is a tool in the hand of regime to intimidate everyone. So in this situation, my heart is broken because it's very tragic to force a woman who cannot walk, who barely can talk, to say on camera that my situation is okay, I am fine with it. What is wrong with this government? I really don't get it, that this act of violence, trying to convince the whole Iranian population that, hey, Arzu is okay if she got shot by a police in Iran. So Arzu's father, the same. But at the same time, I have to say, my sources telling me that Arzu and her sister was supposed to say on camera to deny the shooting with hijab issue. So they resisted. So far, they resisted and the Islamic Republic security forces failed. But at the same time, their life is at risk. They're all of them, their whole family are under pressure to claim that there is nothing link between morality police, hijab, and Arzu being paralyzed, which is absolutely a big lie.
Well, can I ask you, why would the Iranian authorities be trying to get Arzu and her family to deny any connection to a hijab issue in this shooting?
Because they know that this is going to be controversial. We are reaching to the anniversary of the brutal murder of Mahsa Jina Amini. They know that this is the way that they can get away from it, from being punished from international community. But at the same time, they know the anger of Iranian women. They know that people are furious and they're trying to provide any potential uprising. The same that, you know, after the murder of Mahsa, I mean, people got angry and they took to the streets. So that is why they try to actually delete all the links and information which shows that Arzu's car was shot by the police because of compulsory veiling.
What can you say about how people inside Iran are reacting to this incident and how much do they know about what really happened?
That's the problem. Iranian regime trying to control the information. That's why there are a few people now learning what's going on in hospital, that Arzu is being under pressure. So, for instance, as soon as I published the information on my social media, I got videos from Iranian women walking unveiled in the street, referring to Arzu Badri and saying that, we're not going to give up. We know what happened to Arzu Badri, but we still take off our hijab. We walk in the street until the day that we are free.
It's my colleague Michael Lippin speaking with Masi Alinejad of VOA's Persian service. Turning now to Europe, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is in Kyiv, and the Ukrainian Navy chalks up another success. VOA's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has the details.
On Friday, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi arrived in Kyiv for the first ever official visit of an Indian Prime Minister to Ukraine. Modi laid flowers at the Mahatma Gandhi monument in Kyiv and met with members of the Indian diaspora. He also met with President Zelensky, and together with Zelensky they commemorated the children whose lives were lost in the war following Russia's invasion. Zelensky and Modi both emphasized that the main task for both countries is to end Russia-Ukraine war and establish a fair and equitable peace. Zelensky also thanked India for supporting Ukrainian peace efforts. Modi ensured that India supports resolving of all problems through dialogue and diplomacy, and said this is what he mentioned to President Putin when visited Russia last month.
And last month as well, when I visited Russia to meet President Putin, I told him very clearly that problems cannot be resolved on the battlefield. The only way of resolving problems is through dialogue and through diplomacy, and that without losing any further time, we should move towards that direction.
The visit symbolically takes place on the day of the national flag of Ukraine and just before one of the main holidays of Ukraine, Independence Day, which is celebrated on August 24th. On the occasion of National Flag Day, President Volodymyr Zelensky took part in the ceremony of raising the largest flag of Ukraine in Kyiv.
Ми зараз в цій війні в першу чергу відвоюємо для України.
During his speech, Zelensky said that Ukraine is fighting for the right for justice for its nation, for freedom, dignity and safety of the Ukrainian state. He said that those who come to Ukraine to destroy it will get ruins back at their home. Meanwhile, Ukrainian naval forces confirmed the destruction of a Russian ferry used for transporting military equipment in the port of Kavkaz in the Krasnodar region in Russia. According to local reports, the ferry had 30 tanks of fuel on board when it went down. A Ukrainian Navy spokesperson noted that because the ferry had sunk, the normal operations of the port are blocked. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Protests over election reform continue in Indonesia. We'll have that story in a moment. First, though, Turkey has been mediating between Ethiopia and Somalia, which are locked in a dispute, mainly over sea access for Ethiopia. At issue is a deal that Ethiopia signed earlier this year with the self-proclaimed breakaway region of Somaliland. Ankara's mediation efforts are seen as underlying its growing influence in the strategic Horn of Africa region. Dorian Jones has that story from Istanbul. Today,
we conclude... Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan described this month's second round of talks between his Ethiopian and Somali counterparts as constructive, even though no deal was reached. Ethiopian-Somali tensions have been on the rise since January, when Ethiopia signed a memorandum of understanding with Somaliland, a breakaway state from Somalia. Under the agreement, Ethiopia would secure sea access in exchange for recognizing the breakaway state, a deal condemned by Somalia for infringing on its territorial integrity. Geopolitical consultant Norman Rickliffs offered his assessment of the situation.
Obviously, Ethiopia needs access to a coastline. It's the second largest country in Africa. It's a booming economy. And somehow that deal needs to be made. But it's not going to be easy because of the previous deal earlier this year with Somaliland.
Somalia this week threatened to block access to Ethiopian airlines in the latest round of diplomatic tensions. But analysts say Ankara is well placed to mediate, given its historical and deepening ties with both countries. The Somali parliament ratified an agreement earlier this year under which Turkey will help protect its territorial waters and participate in the search for hydrocarbons there. Turkey is one of the largest investors in Ethiopia. Analysts say more than diplomatic kudos are at stake for Ankara in resolving the Ethiopia-Somalia tensions, given the region's location on one of the world's key trade routes and vast untapped potential. Again, geopolitical consultant Norman Ricklefs.
There's a reason why the Horn of Africa has American military bases, Chinese military bases, Japanese even have a base in that area. It's hydrocarbon resources and other resources like agricultural resources have not been developed and would need networks of infrastructure that a country like Turkey could provide if there was security and stability.
Talks are set to resume in September. Analysts say success would underscore Turkey's growing influence in a region of increasing international competition. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Thousands of people rallied in several cities in Indonesia on Friday, pressuring the government to issue rules for regional elections amid outrage over an attempt by the parliamentary allies of the president, Joko Widodo, to change them in their favor. The push by lawmakers to change the rules would have effectively been a reversal of a constitutional court decision on Tuesday, which upheld the minimum age of 30 for candidates and made it easier for parties to make nominations. That's protester and university student Aulia Tariq Akbar. He says the demonstrators want to give parliament a warning not to play with democracy. The protests were accompanied by a fury on social media aimed at the influential president, who stood to gain from the proposed changes that would have allowed his son to seek office in Central Java and blocked an influential government critic from running for the high-profile post of Jakarta governor. The president has yet to comment on the protests, although when asked Wednesday about the attempt by parliament to change the election rules, he said he respected Indonesia's democratic institutions. And finally today, the United Nations says it's working with governments and health officials in Africa to contain the outbreak of Mpox on the continent. Columbus Mavungo reports that Zimbabwe is screening at all of the country's ports of entry. Steve Miller narrates this report.
In a statement Thursday, the UNICEF Regional Director for Eastern and Southern Africa, Etleva Dalili, said more than 200 confirmed cases have been detected in five countries: Burundi, Kenya, Rwanda, South Africa, and Uganda. Dalili added that UNICEF is responding to the Mpox outbreak, which involves the new Clade 1b variant, alongside the World Health Organization and the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as part of a government response with local partners. Dr. Francis Kasolo, director and head of the WHO and the Africa Union and UN Economic Commission for Africa, summed up the Mpox situation on the continent in a joint WHO-Africa CDC meeting.
There's still much work to be done. It is imperative that we remain vigilant and proactive in our efforts to combat Mpox.
Last week, the WHO declared Mpox a public health emergency of international concern, following a surge of Mpox in the Democratic Republic of Congo and a growing number of other African countries. Botswana and Zimbabwe are some of the countries now screening for Mpox after their neighbor South Africa recorded three deaths from the new strain. Douglas Mumbashora, Zimbabwe's health minister, says because people come and go as they choose, his government wants to minimize cases of Mpox in his country. Hence, they have begun screening for the viral ailment at all ports of entry.
Any possible contacts with people who have had monkeypox and appropriate measures and tests can be done.
Dr. Norman Matara of Zimbabwe's Doctors for Human Rights says given the country's poor health delivery system, keeping Mpox out is better than trying to contain it after cases appear.
It saves the nation a lot of money because treatment is always expensive. It also prevents us from unnecessary lockdowns, restrictions of movements, and so forth, like what we saw with COVID-19.
For Columbus Mavhunga, I'm Steve Miller, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.